In this week's episode, I'm joined by Dr. Thomas Williams. Tom has worked in the CWP Eating Disorder Service since May 2022. He works across community and specialist inpatient settings. He is the psychiatric lead in the regional type 1 diabetes and disordered eating clinic and the local MED lead, and also works with patients with complex presentations, acting as a link person for the local acute trust. He is also a member of the Royal College of Psychiatry Eating Disorder Faculty Executive Committee. This episode with Tom was really, really informative to talk about the link between type 1 diabetes and disordered eating, also known as TIDE. We speak about the development of Tom's TIDE clinic and how, unfortunately, funding is not being provided to ensure that this clinic can continue. I really enjoyed this episode with Tom and left feeling like I had a lot more knowledge about the condition TIDE. Hello and welcome back to the Full of Beans podcast. Today I am joined by Tom Williams, who works at the Cheshire and Wirral Partnership in the Northwest. So it's lovely to have you, Tom. How are you doing today?
Very happy to be here. Thanks so much for inviting me, Hannah. Yeah, so I'm a consultant psychiatrist. I work in Cheshire and Wirral Partnership in the Eating Disorder Service, working in the Northwest. And perhaps more relevantly today, I work as part of our Type 1 Diabetes and Disordered Eating Service, which has a little bit of a bigger footprint and is a joint venture with Aintree University Hospital as well.
Amazing. So I guess to start with, do you want to tell us a bit more about type 1 diabetes and eating disorders, and if people haven't heard of kind of that combination before, what that is?
Yeah, of course. So I work across a sort of, if you like, general eating disorder service, but one of the roles that I have is within our TIDE service, our type 1 diabetes and disordered eating service. So TIDE, as I'll refer to it as TIDE going forward, if that's okay, is a presentation of an eating disorder that has, I think, gained a bit more public recognition recently, which is really important. Used to be called diabulimia. People might have heard that term. That term's not used so much anymore. It's not felt to describe the presentation very well. So people who have this condition, they have type 1 diabetes, which many listeners may be aware of, but just briefly, type 1 diabetes is basically, it's a kind of an autoimmune condition whereby people struggle with regulation of their blood sugars because they don't produce enough insulin in their body. And it's different from some other types of diabetes like type 2 diabetes. But in this condition, essentially, for people to be well, physically well, they need to use insulin to regulate their blood sugars. Now, for reasons that I'm sure we'll get into today, which are many and varied, sometimes people struggle with an eating disorder alongside having type 1 diabetes, whereas in many other eating disorders, this might manifest as restrictive eating or purging or many other manifestations of an eating disorder. In this case, people will omit their insulin. They won't take their insulin. And you might wonder why that is, but it's in general, it's because even though it's very risky and leads to people becoming really quite physically unwell, it leads to their body using a different metabolic pathway, which leads to weight loss. And so people have described it quite poignantly, I think, as like finding a hack. It's like they've discovered a hack that allows them to kind of eat what they want, if you like, while losing weight. So it is a condition that brings a lot of risks with it. It's a condition that's under-recognized and often carries with it a lot of secrecy. So it's something that our service has been trying to support people with.
Yeah. Well, I mean, amazing explanation. So thank you so much. And I think it really upsets me when I hear about it, because as you said, it's people almost see it as a hack. And it's one of those things, again, where it's like weight loss at any cost. You know, I'm willing to do anything in order to lose weight or, you know, sustain a certain weight. And I guess with that in mind, would you mind just sharing a bit about what the risks are that are associated with that? Because I'm just thinking, if people are thinking, oh, that sounds like a great hack, to actually realize it is extremely dangerous.
Yes, of course. Yeah. I think you described it really well there when you said kind of weight loss at any cost, and kind of it really helps illustrate the position that people with eating disorders are in and how it takes such central importance to their lives. So there are many risks associated with people with type 1 diabetes not taking their insulin. I guess we can divide them roughly into acute and chronic risks. Mm. So acutely, if people don't take their insulin and their blood sugars run to really high levels, they can develop a very dangerous condition called diabetic ketoacidosis. So this is a condition whereby the blood sugars are really high. This other metabolic pathway that I mentioned earlier is running into overdrive, if you like, and it leads the person to a very dangerous position with their sort of acid-base balance in their bloodstream. And what that essentially leads to is lots of symptoms like abdominal pain, nausea, and it can be life-threatening. It's a situation where people have to go to accident and emergency for very urgent treatment and can end up in ITU. It also carries with it a 5% mortality rate. So it's a really, really significant and dangerous presentation. In terms of chronic risks, if people really struggle with their blood sugars and they're high for long periods of time, and we're talking sort of months to years, it leads to a lot of different, it can basically affect almost any organ system in the body. But some of the most prominent ones are, it can lead to nephropathy, which is kidney damage. And that can become so severe that the person can have renal failure and end up on dialysis. It can cause what we call retinopathy, which is damage to the back of the eye, which is often treated with a range of different sort of laser treatments and that sort of thing when you're trying to keep on top of it, but ultimately it can lead to vision loss. And perhaps another one that people might be aware of is what we call neuropathy, which is nerve damage. Which is an incredibly painful situation for a person to be in. There are medications that can be helpful, but even on really quite high doses of analgesic medication, people really struggle with burning, shooting, pains, particularly in their limbs, and eventually they can lose sensation as well. And aside from that, it also increases people's risk of cardiovascular complications like heart attack and stroke. So definitely something to be taken very seriously.
Yeah, absolutely. Wow. Yeah, I think when you say it all like that, it's actually, you know, it's terrifying the implications that can have. And I know that you set up a service for people that were struggling with type 1 diabetes with disordered eating. Where did that come from? You know, you've just explained probably where that came from. But not everyone has a Tide service. So it'd be really interested to hear about the process of setting that up.
Yeah. So first thing is I wish everybody had a Tide service because there was a recent parliamentary inquiry. Well, it was about a year ago now, but it's still very pertinent. That was led by Theresa May and Knowsley MP George Howarth. The topic of diabetes is very close to their hearts and highlighted the importance of Tide services, which should be rolled out across the nation, but unfortunately haven't as yet. But we were lucky enough to get funding from NHS England. And so our period of work started in March 2023. We were actually sort of a second wave. There were some first wave Tide pilots in the London and Wessex areas, and they did amazing work. Some people might be aware of the Compassion Project, and if they're not, it's definitely worth checking out because they created an integrated service between diabetes teams and eating disorder services, recognizing that there was this gap that people were falling between with really tragic consequences. So it was recognized that people really, you kind of had two sets of services that were struggling to talk to each other. So you had people in diabetes services and the teams would be aware something's going on with this person. Their blood sugars are really high. They're really young and they're getting a lot of complications, but we're not quite sure what's going on. And so the teams didn't really have the knowledge or training to explore whether it might be an eating disorder that was contributing to that. And then on the other side, you had people who might have actually come to the attention of eating disorder services, but the teams didn't have the confidence or training to support people with type 1 diabetes, especially if they're presenting as acutely unwell. So there were two sets of teams who didn't have the training or confidence to manage them, and they were struggling to communicate with each other as well. That's what kind of problem was recognized, and that's what led to the first wave pilot and then the second wave pilot, of which we are one of five. So they are dotted around the country. So we're in Cheshire and Merseyside, but there are others in Leicester, Coventry, Hull and West Riding, and I think I'm missing somebody, but there is another one. So these are the second wave pilots. So that's how we came to be, and that's where our funding came from. It sort of happened as I was coming into my job in eating disorders, and I was lucky enough to be able to be put forward to be part of the team. But it was a process of bidding for the funding.
Which is just such a horrible reality that, you know, I was going to pick up on that when you introduced it and you said, you know, we were lucky enough to get the NHS funding. And it just shouldn't be something that's luck or what have you. It should be something that, as you said, every trust or, you know, what have you, should have this service, because it really shouldn't be a postcode lottery for people depending on where they live. Oh, I can get support for this, or actually there's nothing for me. And I hear it so often with other conditions as well, that if there isn't a service, then there isn't support. That's as simple as it is, basically.
I fully agree with you there, Hannah. It's a terrible set of circumstances. It's almost as if a tied service is seen as something of a luxury or like a bonus, when it really is, in our view, an essential service. People really need that sort of joined up approach in order to support them in making positive changes.
Yeah. And I'm really interested to hear from you as to kind of what that looks like, because it's interesting. Actually, yesterday I mentioned that I was at Parliament and Leslie and Neil Davison, whose daughter Megan actually died, who had tied. They were saying how, you know, ultimately the most important thing is communication, because diabetes treatment is, when you look at it written down, it kind of does encourage disordered eating behaviours, but then recovery from an eating disorder very much conflicts sort of the treatment or the, you know, the ways that you need to eat and live with diabetes. So what does that kind of joined up care look like?
Yeah, so I work with a great team with some really skilled people, and it's kind of a 50-50 split of kind of eating disorder expertise and diabetes expertise. And so we work as a single joined up multidisciplinary team. So people are referred to us usually from their diabetes service. Part of what's led to that is that we've kind of rolled out an educational program in the region as well to help people recognize when somebody might be struggling with TIDE. And that certainly led to more referrals. So who do we have in our team? We've got me as the consultant psychiatrist, and we've got two diabetologists. We're lucky to have two. There's Chong and Emeka. We've got a diabetic specialist nurse called Anne. We've got a dietitian called Jade, who has experience of both working on diabetes wards and in an eating disorder service. So she's kind of uniquely qualified. We're very lucky to have her. And we've got two therapeutic practitioners as well. We've got both of whom are called Laura. One is a therapist and one's a clinical psychologist. And obviously our all-important admin, who's also called Laura.
So wow. The Laura crew.
Laura's in the team, but it's a bit of a long-running joke now. So yeah, we get our referrals and we discuss people in our multidisciplinary team meeting and think about kind of suitability and things. And then we arrange an assessment. And from the assessment, we do it joined up. There's usually one of our kind of diabetes experts, if you like, and one of our eating disorder experts. And we sort of do it as a really joined up assessment and try and just really talk the person through their narrative, really, of their experience with both diabetes and their eating disorder, see what themes emerge. And then after that, they will have regular input, which is usually joined up between the diabetic specialist nurse and the dietitian, because we find that the piece of work that one does affects the other, because the two are so intrinsically linked. And I think because of their skills and training, they're able to do this with a sense of nuance that works for the person, bearing in mind their eating disorder, but also their needs to sort of attend to their insulin use and their nutrition. And then alongside that, they'll have a course of therapy from one of our Laura's. And they use a range of different modalities, but there isn't any sort of set guidance on what therapeutic modality to use in TIDE. But we do tend to find that sometimes models like mantra aren't always specifically the best fit for people. So we try to use a bit of flexibility, and they've drawn on skills from family therapy and cognitive analytic therapy, as well as psychodynamic therapy, and sometimes a sort of structured clinical management approach. And alongside that, they'll get joint medical reviews, usually every couple of months or so, from myself and one of the diabetologists, just to sort of maintain some oversight, review medication and that sort of thing. So that's kind of how our model works. We don't kind of work on a set timeline, because what we've found is that people with this presentation, they've often lived with it for a very long time, like many people with eating disorders, before coming to the attentionist services. So there's often quite a lot to work on that's been embedded over a long period of time. So it's very variable timescale as to how much input people need.
Mm-hmm. And, you know, I think from what you just said there, I've picked up on two main things about the importance of this service, or what would make this really useful. Is one is the communication between the different groups, and using, you know, no matter what your specialism or your expertise, having that multidisciplinary team so that all kind of angles are covered and providing that wraparound care for people. But also what I thought was really interesting, what you were saying, and I'm a great believer of as well, rather than looking at someone's diagnosis, and I think this across the board, is actually looking at the individual and thinking, what do they need right now? What's going to be the most supportive for them? So it's fantastic to hear that you aren't set in stone about the treatment modality that you use or the length of time, because ultimately somebody may need a longer duration or a shorter duration. And I think even within treatment, you know, the modality that you need in that moment may vary. So it's so fantastic to hear that you have that flexibility and that people have a range of different specialists working with them.
Yeah, yeah. And I guess the other thing to mention in terms of sort of people's individual needs is, again, like in many eating disorder services, we have a lot of people who are neurodiverse within this patient group as well. So certain reasonable adjustments need to be made to make it work for them.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that is so key. And I think we are seeing, you know, the research is coming available more and more about the prevalence of neurodiversity within eating disorder settings. So yeah, a really good point to raise. If people are listening and maybe they work in an eating disorder service, or maybe they work in a diabetes service, maybe they don't have that. I know you mentioned the program with the training that you did, which sounds fantastic. Are there some key takeaways, or I guess signs that people could look out for that they may need to, I suppose it may be more on the diabetes service going to the eating disorder service, that there might be an issue?
Yeah, that's a really good question. So I think every diabetes service probably has, they're probably very well aware of several people that they work with who for whatever reason struggle to get their diabetes under control. There can be lots of underlying reasons for that. And I think TIDE is just sort of one reason for it. There are people who, for whom primarily it's not so much about the kind of body image, size, shape, weight side of things. It's really more about their relationship with diabetes. And, you know, this, it makes me feel really ignorant to say this, but I really didn't fully appreciate the burden of diabetes. And I still don't, because it's not my experience, but it's really given me an insight into the burden of diabetes working on this team. I think before this, I was like, oh, you know, people have a couple of injections a day and kind of watch what they eat and then they can remain healthy. But it is really such a heavy burden to carry. It really does occupy people's thoughts every moment of the day, really, and it affects so many decisions throughout the day. So sometimes it can definitely be to do with that. If people suspect it's more to do with a sort of TIDE presentation, we do have, and it's quite a blunt tool, but it can be helpful. People might be aware of a screening tool called the, and I do think this name is really unfortunate, it needs to be changed, but it's based on an acronym, the SCOF. Screening tool. So there's a modified version that can be used in diabetes clinics to help screen. So yeah, if people have an inkling that there's something going on with this person who has really high blood sugars in spite of the support we're trying to give them, then they could perhaps try and make a bit of an extended clinic appointment with them, because that I know diabetes services, like so many NHS services, are overstretched. And it's not that people don't want to help. I think sometimes they just don't have the time. But if somebody really seems to be in trouble, if they create perhaps a bit of an extended clinic slot and try and do the modified SCoF, which would hopefully lead to a productive conversation and some thoughts about what to do next, that can be one way of approaching it.
Amazing. And we can put a link to that in the show notes. So that's fantastic. But I do completely agree with you. I think that there's something about eating disorder resources that the acronyms are often revolve around eating and food, and like the marzipan, for example. You don't need to focus on food.
Yeah, I agree. I think the idea is to try and create something memorable, but like, let's make it something else.
Yeah. Well, random tangent, but when I worked at Cambridge University as a research assistant, one of the ladies in the admin team, it was an unofficial title, of course, but everyone, when they were doing their research projects, would go to her for the acronym because she was like the queen of the acronyms. And I feel like you're in every single research to do, there's always an acronym. And you're like, where have you plucked that from? That's so rogue.
One of my colleagues has a similar skill. Dr. Carhill, who I work with, has a real passion for acronyms as well.
Brilliant. Well, there we go. We know who to come to. But that's really helpful. And I think that, you know, what you said about people wanting to help but maybe not having the time, I think that is such a sad reality of where we currently are with the system. But then I also think if we don't provide that care, then ultimately patients end up taking more time as their condition gets worse.
Yeah.
In terms of your service, have you got any sort of data or research on the outcomes that you've had from implementing this service?
Yeah, so part of the deal, if you like, with NHS England was that we had to gather outcome data at baseline, 6 months, 12 months, however, just at 6 monthly intervals, however long it took. And so we have diligently gathered that as we've gone along. Now, the official data, I will stress, is currently being processed, and we've got our fingers crossed that we're going to catch sight of that next month, but let's wait and see. But we've processed it ourselves, and we can see really quite significant reductions across a range of scales. So an indicator of how quote unquote good, if you like. We try to steer away from like terms like good and bad when we're talking about diabetes control. But I guess an indicator of like effective blood sugar control is what we call the HbA1c blood test. And that the higher that number is, the more that person struggles with their blood sugar control. So we've seen really consistent reductions in that across the board. Obviously, there are some exceptions. Some people continue to struggle and we're still offering them support. But on average, there has been a significant reduction. In addition to that, we did a few different outcome scales, including one that looked at diabetes distress, one that looked at eating disorder cognitions, one that looked at day-to-day functioning. And again, really consistent average reductions there. Another thing that's been a marker of good outcomes for people is that we've been able to support, I think so far it's 6 or 7 people, and there's at least 3 or 4 people still in the pipeline in going on to an insulin pump. So perhaps just to explain a little bit about insulin pumps is that historically people have managed their diabetes by administering insulin through injections, often 3 times a day or more. It's often kind of like a long-acting insulin that operates in the background, plus several doses of short-acting insulin alongside mealtimes, which is obviously quite a significant burden for people. So there's a move now towards, if people feel it's the right thing for them, going on a pump. So it's a relatively discreet piece of machinery that is sort of stuck to a part of the body that's at like the tummy or somewhere, which gradually administers insulin over the course of the day. And there is a way of getting that to communicate with the person's blood sugar sensor as well, so that they can talk to each other. And it's the closest thing we have at the moment to an artificial pancreas, essentially, which is the organ that secretes insulin, which is often dysfunctional in people with type 1 diabetes. So for many of our patients, when they started with us, that felt completely out of reach, because the fear of having tighter glycemic control is the weight gain that goes with that. When a person has lost weight through omitting insulin, it's inevitable that when they get tighter blood sugar control, there is some degree of weight restoration. And we found that that's incredibly variable from individual to individual, but it tends to be less dramatic if it's done in a sort of gradual, supported way. And so, yeah, that for them, it felt really out of reach because in their mind, tight control would instantly equal unmanageable weight restoration. But we've been able to support them through it by providing them with therapy alongside it and preparing them for it. And they've had really good outcomes and they've stuck with it. And they've found that one patient described really clearly that, as she described it, the diabetes noise just became a lot quieter so she could get on with her day and not worry so much about the diabetes.
I mean, I'm maybe making an assumption here, but if I kind of correlate it to my experience of anorexia, the more I engaged with restriction, the louder the eating disorder voice became. And then, yes, when weight restoration begins, the voice does get louder. But, you know, it's very similar to what you explained. If you're able to process that with therapy and work through that, and it's gradual. I think a lot of the time in recovery, people think that they're going to wake up tomorrow and they're going to have gained 10 stone. Right. And that's not the reality of it. You know, if we're thinking about it rationally, it took time for you to lose the weight. So it's also going to take time for the weight to restore. But the further you get along in that recovery and the more processing you've done, you've got those coping mechanisms, you then, you know, the eating disorder food noise does reduce. And I think what you were saying about the pump as well, that's a really interesting concept, but I was almost thinking, because it's one less thing that you then have to think about, or it's kind of like one less decision you have to make in terms of, you know, I think in recovery, one thing that can be so difficult is like constantly being the one that has to make the decision to eat. Yeah. But you do have to be that person to make that decision. Nobody can make that for you. So it's almost like, you know, now you've only got the decision of what's on your plate, as opposed to I've got to, you know, have my insulin again. And actually, it would be really easy to just not have my insulin. And additionally, with what you're talking about, you know, neurodiversity and stuff, I imagine for people that have ADHD, maybe, you know, the act of taking insulin three times a day is something that maybe gets forgotten. So to have that consistency with the pump sounds fantastic.
You're exactly right. I can think of one client in particular who, not yet officially been diagnosed, but we've worked extensively with him and done screening tests, and he has all the hallmarks of ADHD, and we have a shared understanding that he likely does. And he went on a pump, and it's certainly been incredibly helpful for him. Yeah, because, yeah, as with so many people with ADHD, just the kind of mental kind of burden of organization was pretty huge for him. I think also thinking about people who have more in the region of autistic spectrum condition, for them, the sensory aspect of multiple injections a day can be really challenging. So we have one patient who's working towards a pump at the moment, and that's a really big factor for her as well. So yeah, it can be so multifactorial. And it's really interesting to hear what you said about kind of having the right support to ride out that kind of increase in the kind of eating disorder noise.
Yeah, absolutely. I think that is one of those things, unfortunately, that gets worse before it gets better in terms of that kind of internal voice or those thoughts, however you want to describe it. But I think it's incredibly important that you have someone to kind of walk through that with you, because I do believe part of recovery is being able to sit with those uncomfortable emotions. I think a lot of the time the behaviors that people have are a way to avoid those distressing emotions. So I think it's really important to be able to sit with them. One question I just wanted to ask, you just said that you have one patient that is working towards a pump. Is there a process people have to go through in order to go from having the injections to a pump?
Yeah, in a sense there is, yes. So I'm thinking of this lady as an example, and we do it all in collaboration with her home diabetes service. So I guess something that I've not mentioned is that while people work with us, they retain their home diabetes service and we liaise closely with them. And part of the work sometimes can be about kind of enhancing or repairing the relationship with their home diabetes service, because so many people, I'm speaking, you know, for some people, there are so many great people working in diabetes services and providing a fantastic service, but sometimes the service that's delivered can be quite traumatizing to people, especially people who struggle with their body image or their self-esteem. So things like being asked to being weighed in a really public way in a clinic room, or just incredible focus on carb counting and calories and all these sorts of things. And kind of this sense that you're being criticized for being a quote unquote bad diabetic and that sort of thing, it can really leave its mark and lead to the person just feeling quite alienated and less likely to attend these vital appointments. So it can be really, it can actually be quite dangerous. And I'm not saying this as a diabetologist. One of my colleagues could probably explain this a bit better than I could, but it's actually quite dangerous to come down too quickly with your blood sugars and to make your control too tight too soon. It can lead to certain eye problems, actually. So we support people with a gradual process. So they need to be somewhat in the range of tighter control before they can go on a pump. So we've got to support them with regular administration of their insulin and to work towards it. The other part of that as well is that the pumps aren't infallible. They're really fantastic at taking away a lot of the burden of diabetes and injecting, but you do need to interact with it to a degree. So for example, you may sometimes need to ask it to give you a little boost if you've had a certain type of meal. So it's not fully automatic. So there needs to be some demonstration of engagement with it, because sometimes if you don't interact with it properly, the pump sort of shuts down, and then So people have to be trained and prepared to go on them. So they're a great thing, but still not a magic wand.
Yeah, absolutely. No, and I mean that you makes sense, doesn't it? If you're having something like that that is so important, then you would definitely want that training. You mentioned about basically all the numbers that are involved with diabetes, and is there a possible, or is there a, you know, a way of living with type 1 diabetes without being consumed by the numbers? Because I just, as you said earlier, you know, type 1 diabetes is something that really impacts people's lives. I've got a few friends that have type 1 diabetes, and they have to regularly monitor, and it has made them conscious about their food choices and numbers and everything like that. And I just wondered what recovery from an eating disorder looks like if you still have to be conscious of those things.
Yeah, that's a really good question. And you know what? I think Anne or Jade, a nurse or a dietitian, could probably answer that a lot better than I could. I think my view is that it's probably never possible to fully move away from the numbers with diabetes. There are ways of kind of modifying the way that we process and interact with them, I think. So I think one thing, and it's a principle that we often work on, is like, let's try and take a step away from perfection. Let's try and forget about this idea of perfect control, and move towards something that feels good enough and safe for now. And then it's about sort of just gradually chipping away from there. So for some of our patients, it's good enough that they just take their long-acting insulin, because that, in essence, it saves their lives by keeping them out of diabetic ketoacidosis. But that gives us that's, you know, there's still work to do. We wouldn't say that that's an end point, but it gives us space and time to work on the other things. And I think, yeah, there can be so much emphasis on getting things perfect when it comes to carb counting and watching what you eat and things. So sometimes Anne and Jade will work with just a bit of a looser model that's based a lot more on like rough estimates are going to be good enough for now. Let's not focus on the tiny minutiae. Let's try and step away from that. And then if it's possible to get onto a pump, again, that's a way of sort of removing a substantial amount of that noise.
Yeah, absolutely. And I think that that's such an important thing in terms of perfectionism is such a characteristic that we often see. And I think it often can shift sometimes from, you know, maybe being the perfect diabetic or having the perfect eating disorder to then having the perfect recovery. Yeah. So I think that it's, that's a, you know, the fact that there's that spoke about this on another podcast recently, but that shade of grey, that it doesn't have to be perfect all the time. Like, obviously with diabetes, it, you are a bit more reliant on having things within their certain boundaries, but it doesn't need to be all consuming, and there is flexibility within that.
That's right. Yeah. And I think that's, I think people experience that, that strive for perfectionism though, because of what can sometimes be drilled into them, especially if they're diagnosed very young in diabetes clinics and being told all these things like, well, if you don't get it perfect, you're going to lose your eyesight and that sort of thing. And these things just really obviously deeply affect people. And so there can sometimes be this mindset of sort of, well, I can't do it perfectly, so I'm not going to do it at all. And yeah, it's just another kind of indication of kind of like the really distinct and unique trauma that can arise from growing up with diabetes or developing it later in life.
Absolutely. And I guess it's striking that balance with the communication when people are first diagnosed and they're receiving that support, because you want to tell them about the consequences of not managing their insulin appropriately, but equally by scaremongering them, as you said, you then leave that, you know, deep-rooted trauma that, you know, all these messages that they've had about what could potentially go wrong, that would be enough for you to want to measure every minutia, like you said.
Of course, of course. And I think that's where we've had some really successful liaison with our diabetes colleagues, and we've met some great and dedicated people in diabetes teams who really want to know how to kind of do better with these patients. Yeah.
Yeah, amazing. Well, thank you so much. This has been so informative, and I really hope for everybody listening that they've got a lot of insight, whether they're clinician or struggling themselves. I'm just wondering, to finish us off, is there any resources that you've created or anywhere somebody could go if they want to bring this sort of thing into their own service?
In terms of resources, there are resources available online, that some of which were developed by the London and Wessex services. I'll have a little rummage and get some links ready for you. There is something I'd like to highlight, if I may, before we draw things to a close, Hannah, if that's okay. Because unfortunately, at present, the funding for the TIDE services is in jeopardy. So we got the NHS England funding in 2023, and it was originally for 2 years, and then it's actually always supposed to be for 3 years. But anyway, it's actually, that funding is actually drawing to a close in at the latest March of 2026. And what we've been doing is trying to liaise with ICBs to request ongoing funding for TIDE services, whilst highlighting our outcomes, which we mentioned earlier, really high degree of patient satisfaction, high degree of colleague satisfaction as well. The service is really valued both by eating disorder services and diabetes services. In addition to that, it's fully in line with the government's recently revealed 10-year plan, because there's such an emphasis on secondary prevention, and yet services like this aren't being valued. So, and not to mention the parliamentary inquiry, which highlighted the importance of these services and what was going on before they came to be, and what will happen if they go away. Unfortunately, many people will also be aware that ICBs are in a bit of a terrible financial state. And so the answer that we're getting at the moment is there is no money and the service can't continue. So we're trying to raise awareness about this, and we've been approaching members of parliament. We've been speaking to Diabetes UK, the Royal College of Psychiatry. So definitely trying to just kind of raise our voices about this and just emphasize that there's a really high degree of chance that we could lose this vital service in the near future. So sorry to end on a bum note.
No.
It's important to highlight.
Of course it is. And it's such a shame as well, the fact that you've got that funding and had such positive outcomes, but that's not continuing. For people listening, is there anything they can do to support, you know, I'm sure, you know, raising awareness, or are there specific things they can do?
I would certainly, if there's anybody who feels like they'd really like to help, what I'd suggest is writing to their local MP and to make this a matter for Parliament. But there are not just us, but some of the other second wave pilots as well are working quite hard to try and get this up for discussion in Parliament. But if people have the ability to do that, we'd be incredibly grateful, because we feel it's a vital service.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much. It's been such a pleasure to speak to you. So thank you for joining me.
Oh, thanks so much for having me. I've had a great time. Thank you, Hannah.
Thank you so much for listening to this week's episode on the Full of Beans podcast. I really hope you did enjoy it. As a little reminder, this is not a replacement for therapeutic advice, so please do seek support if you are struggling and know that there will always be somebody there to listen. Many thanks once again to our podcast sponsor, Nightingale Hospital. Have a lovely week, and I will see you next week for another episode of the Full of Beans podcast.